Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia.
Garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found. But
yeah, we did. Started to burn too many things we found. Back at Solartopia, here for another hour, we're going to be talking about the Dakota Pipeline, nuclear issues, and cancer with two truly great individuals, Danny Sheehan and Sarah Nelson from the Romero Institute based in Santa Cruz, California. Before we get into it, I want to say a few things. First of all, I'm starting another show, Solartopia, California Solartopia, at the at KPFK Pacifica in Los Angeles. It's 90.7 FM. It's going to be actually broadcast in Los Angeles starting Friday, tomorrow at 6:30 p.m. California time. That's Friday, September 8th in Los Angeles, the California Solartopia show. On Saturday in Los Angeles, in Topanga Canyon, actually, I will be with Barbara Lee and many others, Congresswoman Barbara Lee and many others, giving getting an award, amazingly enough, for being an activist all these years, which has been pure fun for me, let me tell you. And I also want to tell you very pointedly that I am not responsible for that hurricane in the Caribbean there in Texas. All my life I've wondered about this name, Harvey. My father promised my mother he wouldn't name me Harvey, and then he did. And I've always had a hard time relating to the name Harvey. I did like the movie, but this hurricane is none of my doing, or my girlfriend Irma, for that matter. It does prove, however, that global warming is a bigger threat than we ever imagined. I mean, these hurricanes, these tropical storms are being fueled by heated water, by the heated ocean. All that energy building up in the ocean, in the Pacific, in the Atlantic, in the Gulf, that's where these hurricanes, these record hurricanes, are coming from. And in fact, Irma, which is just about to slaughter Florida once again, does not seem to even fit in to Category 5, which is the most powerful, which was what Harvey was. It seems to be they want to now invest a Category 6, and we don't seem to have a box to put these hurricanes in. And the solution for global warming, the number one solution, is to convert our entire energy economy to renewables, which makes perfect economic sense anyway. There's no reason not to do it, except that the Koch brothers and Donald Trump and all these other terrible players are deeply invested in King Kong, coal, oil, nukes, and gas, and they don't want to make the transition to renewable energy. They're too lazy. They're too deeply invested. They seem to think, why a person would seem to think that they need more than $4 billion apiece, which is what the Koch brothers have, is beyond me. And but they are denying us access to renewable energy, which is the most important technological revolution happening in the planet today, if not ever. And this is what they're doing. They're fighting solar energy all over the place whenever they possibly can, especially through their owned and operated state legislatures passing laws against renewable energy. And the result is a devastated economy, which is what's happening to the United States, and B, these terrible, terrible storms that are only going to get worse. I mean, Irma, it seems to be beyond the wind speeds from Irma, and the breadth of that storm seems to be unprecedented in human history. Seems to be like nothing we've ever seen before. And so if we are too stupid and too corrupt and too afflicted with cancer of all these right-wing capitalists to deal with this, then we're just not going to survive. And so my show today and at KPFK starting tomorrow in LA continue to be devoted to the transition, the necessary, important, and economically essential transition to renewable energy. And these hurricanes are in Houston, my understanding is they had 4 feet of rain. I mean, you know, that's the sky falling, folks. That's just unbelievable. And I also understand that anybody in the major media, in the corporate media, in their coverage, even on MSNBC, who links these hurricanes to global warming, gets hammered. We have in the White House someone who's completely incapable. You know, I got to say, once I've been to a couple of gatherings in Los Angeles lately, and people are really depressed. And one of the reasons people are depressed, it's not just that Donald Trump is in the White House. I never call him president, by the way. He's not the president, as far as I'm concerned. But we are depressed by the fact that Donald Trump is in the White House. But we're equally or even more depressed by the fact that a person like Donald Trump exists at all. I mean, this is such an awful, awful, awful human being, full of anger and hatred and pettiness. I mean, he's the most petty person I have ever witnessed in public life. And I was in business for 20 years. I ran our family's uniform schmata business. And, business is business, and you meet tough customers and competitors. I never met anybody as horrible as a human being as Donald Trump. And so this whole spectacle we're seeing of him wrecking the federal government is not just about him wrecking the federal government. It's not just him. It's all the people with him and behind him and around him. But he's just such an awful guy. I mean, I watched 10 minutes once of The Apprentice and got nauseous. It was hard for me to believe that a human being like this exists. I did go to an event with John Nichols, who has a new book out called Horsemen of the Trumpocalypse.
Let's try to get this reconvened.
Now, Danny, is that you?
As soon as we can.
It's me, Sluggo. How are you, bud?
I'm good, buddy. You're trying to, just like all us baby boomers, you're trying to figure out the technology. I'll get you in a sec, okay, brother? Sarah,
okay,
with us, Sarah Nelson?
She's just going to, the staff is calling her right now. Yep.
Okay, great.
She'll be there with you in a second.
So let me just finish my rant here, and then we'll get to the great Danny Sheehan. Where are you, Danny?
I'm sitting in my office in Santa Cruz. I just arrived back here from Standing Rock. And so just had a big staff meeting.
Let me finish up here with the Donald. So
it
occurred to me that, you know, and you can certainly comment on this, Danny, it occurred to me that it's not just that these horrible people are in the White House and wrecking our federal government and destroying social justice and ecological sanity and all these other terrible things we're doing. It's that they exist at all, that our species has created such a crop of absolutely loathsome human beings who are completely void of empathy, compassion, or common sense. I mean, you know, I see no socially redeeming attributes for Donald Trump, who was raised a racist. His father denied housing to black people. He was such an awful landlord that Woody Guthrie wrote a song about him. It's just a spectacle of this guy every day doing things that are just absolutely loathsome. You just kind of wring your hands that our species has created such a being. Do you get that feeling, Danny?
Oh yeah. Now, I think that one of the major threats that we have right now, the challenges that we have, is to not allow his removal from office or his quitting the office, whichever the two happen first, to be interpreted as simply a bad apple, you know, an individual who, you know, had a certain clinical mental illness or something. you know, and relieve him from his duties under the 25th Amendment, you know, and then bring in Pence, who has basically the same exact value system, but he's just a little less candid about it. You know, the fact of the matter is that the values, if you can call them that, that he espouses are systematic values that have laid in the shadows of the American culture as an imperialist, you know, white man's burden, manifest destiny, a racialist, imperialist, capitalist operation, at least since the robber baron era from 1868 to 1898, but actually even earlier with Alexander Hamilton, you know, being the lawyer representing the mercantile interest in the colonies. There's been an intrinsic aspect of the American culture that has got a dark and sinister dimension. It's the sinew, it's the muscle of the country that has caused it to be the largest military power in the history of the human species. And so that what we have to try to do is understand how it is that a person like Donald Trump could have been raised up inside a two-party system, which is basically a one-party system. It's the transnational corporate capitalist structure of the Republican and Democratic parties, which are forthrightly funded directly by the major robber barons, you know. And so what we have to do is figure out how to turn this crisis into an opportunity. Again, taking the classic Chinese symbol for crises, which is tragedy and opportunity. And what we have to do is translate this into the opportunity of genuinely establishing a progressive and morally ethical political movement inside the United States. We don't have to create it de novo. It exists in incipient form. What we have to do is bring it into full manifestation. In my opinion, we have to all focus on, for example, the Progressive Caucus, the 74 members of the Progressive Caucus, Bernie Sanders being the only one in the Senate, but 73 other people in the House of Representatives, virtually all of whom come from districts with a major university at the heart of them. And we have to get them to put forth a full-scale program, a full platform for the Democratic Party, a justice Democratic platform, and put it forward with budget alternatives, full-scale programs for each of the major administrative agencies of the executive branch, and have the Democratic Leadership Conference and all of those blue dog, semi-pseudo purple Democrats have to shoot at it and tell the American people why they aren't going to support a single-payer health, which the vast majority of people in the country want. Have them tell why they aren't going to support a massive cut in the military budget, which everybody in the country ultimately supports when they're thinking in their right mind. You know, there's a tactic that we have to kind of join together in pushing on that Progressive Caucus inside the Congress to get them to mobilize and come forward with a full scale affirmative program. That's what we've got to do, because we're faced with this horrible crisis right now. I mean, I just got back a few months ago from being at the Vatican, sitting there talking with Cardinal Turkson, who is the head of the Pontifical Commission on Social Justice. And here's a church, you know, that has in its past, you know, supported the doctrine of discovery and, you know, dehumanizing, you know, the indigenous people of the world. I'm sitting talking with them about changing their fundamental institutional values. And that's what Francis is doing right now. That's the challenge that's going on there. What we have to do is move and seek that kind of an alliance with some people that are trying to do that inside the Catholic Church, seek an alliance with the people inside the Democratic Party who are trying to bring it into a progressive mode. You know, and we have to understand that we sit at the heart of the beast, you know, and so that we have to try to mobilize, take advantage, because it's a crisis. You know, we're looking, I sat in a conference there at the Vatican, the woman who was the head of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change in the United Nations, she said, look, people in the world aren't getting it. We have to reduce the annual global greenhouse gas emissions by 70% by 2020. Not 33% by 2035, you know, that the Obama administration and the Hillary Clinton administration were proposing. You know, this is a radical change that has to take place, or we're going to be faced with absolute tragedy. It's this thing is happening in Texas and Louisiana, you know, pouring 27 trillion gallons of water on them in 24 hours. And what's getting ready to hit Florida here coming on Sunday. These are just the beginning. these are just the beginning. People are whistling past the graveyard here. We have to mobilize in an aggressive, immediate way to deal with this crisis right now. And focusing on Trump, Trump is the best thing that's happened to us in 100 years because he's making it perfectly clear where it is that those two parties are willing to put a person like that in office, put him in the position of having power to eliminate all of the executive orders protecting the environment. He's now opening up all the Indian reservations to massive drilling for oil in coal exploration. He's now removed all the prohibitions against putting oil drilling platforms along the coastlines of the entire country. He's opening up all the public parks to massive drilling. This man is a caricature. He's right out of central casting. You couldn't have a more conspicuous bad guy put in charge of the government by both political parties.
Danny Sheen, I'm going to disagree with you. I think that the central casting would not have produced a ludicrous caricature as absurd and insane as Donald Trump. I want to say a couple things. You are an incredibly articulate guy, and I never want to jump in when you're talking. I do want to say, first of all, that Danny Sheehan, I'm going to ask you to identify yourself in a minute and give us a full rundown. Has Sarah joined us yet? Sarah Nelson, are you with us?
I'm here. I'm
Sarah,
here.
Oh, great. Great. Two greater people I could not ask for. So, first of all, I was deeply amused and thrilled to see Steve Bannon. Don't jump in. I'm going to let this go. I'm going to say a couple things. But first, I was deeply amused and thrilled to see Steve Bannon attacking the Catholic Church, saying that they needed illegal immigrants to fill the churches, and therefore they were supporting the Dreamer program. I thought that was hilarious. I hope Steve Bannon escalates his attacks on the Catholic Church. That would be wonderful. Next thing you know, he'll be calling Pope Francis a wetback. I mean, you know, it's fantastic. Steve, keep up. Keep up, Steve Bannon, please. We need you.
He's already calling him a communist. Yeah.
Oh, my God. Yeah, it's tremendous. And, you know, I also want to comment, Hillary, I have just read a preliminary review of Hillary Clinton's book, and I got to say that she appears, I don't want to jump to conclusions, but she appears in this book to be as awful as she was in the campaign. She's attacking Bernie Sanders, you know, blaming him for her so-called defeat when she actually won the election and refused to fight for it. You know, I guarantee you, if Donald Trump had won a 2.8 million vote margin in the election and had won the exit polls in Florida, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin, he would still be in court. I mean, Hillary Clinton won that election, and then heard Donald Trump was going to be in the White House, and the next day took her dogs for a walk. I mean, please. You know, Donald Trump is in the White House because of Al Gore, John Kerry, and Hillary Clinton refusing to fight. Now, you, Danny, and Sarah are at the cutting edge, as always, you have been all your lives, of social change and social justice and climate or ecological sanity. You were involved in the Silkwood case and in the Iran-Contra situation and so much else. So before we get too far gone here, can you please both identify yourselves briefly, and then I want to jump in to the Dakota Pipeline work that you're doing. But Sarah Nelson, tell us who you are, and then Danny, please.
Well, I'm right now I'm the executive director of the Romero Institute, justice and environmental climate justice organization. We've been in existence since 1980, and it was initially focused mostly on human rights in the world. Danny and I took over the leadership of Romero when the Bush administration's effort to destroy CRISIC succeeded, when they took away our 501c3, saying that we had been involved in political activity when we did the Iran-Contra litigation and exposed the scandal that became the Iran-Contra scandal. That litigation was completely correct under the 501c3 laws, but Bush and his IRS began auditing us and and really ended up concluding that we were involved in political activity. And when we weren't, what we were doing was perfectly legal under the nonprofit status that we had. But that's what happened. And then the people in the Romero Institute resigned and made us their officers, and we put in a new board and kept going. So Romero is a continuation of Christic, which did the Karen Silkwood case, which ultimately stopped the building of all nuclear plants for 30 to 35 years with the conclusions of that lawsuit and the Iran-Contra suit and a number of other major national cases. I came into this as a leader in the National Organization for Women in the 70s when I was the head of the Labor Committee, and our committee launched the campaign to get a congressional investigation into the mystery of what happened to Karen Silkwood, who was working at a plutonium factory in Oklahoma and was a labor leader there and was concerned with health and safety issues at the plant for both the workers and the public. And Kitty Tucker, who was a NOW member in Washington, D.C., after Karen was killed, came, and the two of us began to develop a campaign that we hoped would get to the bottom of who ran Karen Silkwood off the road, who stole all of her documents, who contaminated her house with plutonium, not only in the house but on the food in the refrigerator, and what really happened to her when she was exposing the hazards at a plutonium plant. And that became a very, very big national and international case. She became sort of the first nuclear martyr in the Western world. And ultimately, when Danny came in and became the lead counsel and the chief counsel on that case and put together an investigation and brought in other attorneys, including Jerry Spence, it ultimately won precedence that, as I said before, kept all nuclear plants from being built for almost 35 years. So we, after Silkwood, we formed the Christic Institute, went on to do a number of other cases. It started out as a collective and became too large to be run by a collective, and that's when I became the executive director. And we did a lot of work under Christic, and we're now continuing that under Romero. And our focus now is climate. We have a complete focus on climate change. We see the train is on the track. We know the cascading effect is coming. It's extremely hazardous and dangerous. It's a threat to life on this planet, and we're doing everything we can to mitigate against the worst of it. And that means we're working on the problem, which is the fossil fuel industry. So we are confronting them, investigating them, exposing them, and trying to stop them from prosecuting the water protectors in Standing Rock who stood against them to try to protect their only source of water from their pipeline. And the other project that we're working on is the solution to climate change, which is to put in renewables as fast as we can, solar, wind, as fast as we can. And we've just worked in three counties here with our interfaith community, particularly the Catholic Diocese in the Monterey Diocese, and with the environmental community, the anti-fracking community, and with the elected bodies in the 18 city councils and the three boards of supervisors. And we have just put in, with everyone in this alliance, we've just put in the biggest community choice energy program in the state. And this program will end up reducing about 313 million pounds of carbon, will not go up into the air. And it would have, if it hadn't been for this program, it will not go up in the air in the next 10 years. So it's a very, we've been working on a template that is a very fast way to bring down carbon emissions. And we feel that we need to spread that now to other areas in the state and also in the country, because we all need to bring down emissions as fast as we can if we're going to mitigate against the worst of what's coming in climate.
Very good. It's wonderful. And of course, Danny and Sarah, you are an item, and you got two grown sons and a great couple. And Sarah, I had the great pleasure of visiting you a couple weeks ago with my wonderful daughters, and you're just an amazing, amazing human being. Danny, I haven't seen you for a while. I did run in, by the way, last night. I want you guys quickly to know there is someone who's pitching a new Karen Silkwood movie in Hollywood.
I won't mention his name on the air. He's a friend of a mutual friend. And I emailed you his contact. So take a look at your email when you get done with this. Danny, you are an attorney. And Sarah, you had a tremendously inspiring and successful struggle with cancer. And I do want to talk a bit about that at the very end so we can guide people. And I'll probably have you back separately to talk about that. But we want to be able to guide people to some of your knowledge. So let's do that in the last 5 minutes or so of the show, okay? Danny, you are an attorney. You've been at this forever. You were a major attorney with the Karen Silkwood case. You helped with Sarah break the Iran-Contra story, and now you're at the Dakota Pipeline working with the tribes there. So tell us what you've been doing there. And also, this is a question. We don't like to ask questions I don't know the answer of, but didn't the hurricane, which I refuse to call by its name because it's my name, in Texas affect the refineries that they're supposed to send the stuff down to from the Dakota Pipeline?
No, it did. It did. It's blasted the major refineries where both the Dakota Access Pipeline was supposed to be pumping the 910,000 gallons of crude oil an hour down to, but also the Keystone XL pipeline, the tar sands pipeline that Trump also has ordered in his January 24th executive order to go forward, no matter what the implications are for the environment. Both of those pipelines are designed to bring both the tar sands and the crude oil out of the Bakken down into the Gulf of Mexico to those refineries where it will be refined and put on ships and sold internationally. Not one single drop of the oil.
Are those refineries now underwater?
Well, they've been severely damaged. I don't know exactly what the extent of damage is, and whether when the water drains off, whether they become functional again, what type of damage has been inflicted. You know, whether it's sort of like Fukushima, you know, where there's some sort of permanent damage that's been done. We don't know yet. But the bottom line is
that's a big issue. That's a really big deal,
sure,
Danny.
Is.
And if you'll keep me posted on that, I think we need to make them. I mean, what they're doing basically is they're sending all this crude stuff down to the Gulf, to a swimming pool, basically.
Yeah,
right?
Where it's just backing up. You know, they're just having to store it in big tanks now until they restore those refineries. You know, while they're saying, look, they have to reconsider. For example, the governor of Texas and the mayor of Houston are saying they have to reconsider in their reconstruction that they're going to be doing whether they're going to put all those same buildings and everything else in the same floodplain where they've been destroyed before. Are they going to do the same thing for the refineries? You know, I mean, is this going to teach them their lesson? Or are they going to understand that this is a direct consequence of global climate change, just as these hurricanes that are coming into Florida now are? And either the people are going to start getting it, you know, the entire Northwest is on fire. You know, people who were trying to go there and see the eclipse, you know, a couple of weeks ago, you know, half of them couldn't even see the eclipse because the sky was filled with smoke from all the fires, the forest fires going on and the grass fires. And now we got three of the major states in the South Central United States being inundated with trillions of gallons of water per hour, you know, and we've got now the whole state of Florida getting set to get wiped out, and yet they still keep insisting that it's not global climate change. So we need to know whether they're going to try to rebuild those refineries, whether they're going to conceivably shift over to understanding that, you know, that the petroleum industry needs to move its resources into sustainable alternative energy. I mean, if they were halfway smart, their BP is doing this a little bit now. You know, they're all trying to flog around and advertise, you know, the fact that they've got like 6% of their resources now being devoted to alternative energy. You know, they've got to just shift dramatically in order to survive. But we'll find out
BP,
what the damage is.
Yeah, BP for a while was calling itself Beyond Petroleum. And then they back off on that, and they're going to have to jump back in. So, I mean, this is a huge deal. If these two gargantuan pipelines, which have caused so much havoc, are designed to send all this stuff to places that are underwater, that yes, seems to yes. have a minor impact here on the future. So tell us, Danny Sheehan, what and Sarah, what you have been doing in conjunction with the Native Americans to deal with this pipeline situation and about this
I'll give you a little historic background, and then Danny can give you the update, very, very interesting update on what's going on legally, investigative information is coming out, et cetera. So for people who may not completely know, a year ago, I think it was April of 2016, yeah. there began a stand at Standing Rock, which is one of the nine, they call them tribes, but they're actually bands within the whole Lakota tribe. And Standing Rock, which is Sitting Bull's people, the pipeline from Energy Transfer's partners was coming down from North Dakota, and it wanted to go over to Illinois and then down to the Gulf for shipping out to the world. So it was going to cross the Missouri River just above Bismarck, which is a white-dominated capital of North Dakota, and the people there did not want it there because it would threaten their water. So it went. The Energy Transfers went back to the drawing boards to figure out where they would cross the Missouri River, and decided to do it just above, within a half a mile above the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe's reservation. They deceitfully put together a report for the Army Corps of Engineers, which did not mention the fact that there was this entire reservation community of Lakota people who were not only poor, but also were a minority group, because there's a law that says you cannot endanger a minority community, because there were so many toxic dumps and everything that were put in minority communities that a law was introduced and passed saying that you can't keep doing this, you can't do this. So they ignored that and pretended that there was a minority community up in Bismarck that would be threatened, and therefore they moved it, but they ignored the entire Standing Rock community in that report. So as the people in Standing Rock, and the grandmothers particularly, who initiated and led this, realized this thing was coming, and it would be a threat to their only source of water. So it would be a threat to the very survival of their people and of their grandchildren and children. And they would never have the money to bring in bottled water. They would never, you know, it was just a total threat to their survival. So the grandmother said, it's now or never. We are going to stand against this. And the theme emerged, Mini Waconee, water is life. And we cannot live without water, and we will stand against the pipeline, and we will protest peacefully, and we will be water protectors. So that whole movement began, and by November of last year, there were tens of thousands of people that had either been there or were coming or were there. And by December, when Danny left, there were 10,000 in the main camp, which was the Oshete-Sakowan camp. And these were people that came from all over the world, all over the country. Initially, many, 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 many hundreds of tribes came from all around the country. And it's very, very unusual for the tribes to unify like that. And but they did. They sent truckloads of supplies to the camps, and they came themselves. And it was a very, very big unifying force within. Also, tribes from around the world began to come and send support. And also, 400 religious leaders came to show their support. 3,000 veterans came to show their support. There were just many, many constituencies and people who came. And everyone, the rules in the camps, which were set by the Lakota people, were that it had to be peaceful, there could be no guns, that had to be prayerful. They did ceremony every day. They had a fire in the center of the camp that was the sacred fire. They demonstrated right in the front lines where the pipeline was coming down, but they did so prayerfully. Now, the response that they had from the other side, from Energy Transfers and from their private security, militarized security force, Tiger Swan, an offshoot of Blackwater, was very violent and with water cannons and rubber bullets and concussion grenades toxic mace and so what they did, they damaged a lot of people. I mean, one woman lost her eye, another woman lost most of her arm, and they just attacked people for hours with water cannons when it was 0 degrees and people were freezing. So it was very, very violent, and yet the people, for the most part, continued to pray and to hold their hands up and protest the continuation of the pipeline. So then, as there were differences legally going on, and there was a case that was being filed in D.C. to try to stop this, there was a tremendous amount of pressure on the Army Corps of Engineers to not allow them to go under the reservoir where that was the reservoir for the Lakota people, and tremendous pressure being applied on, you know, by people online. And Obama withdrew the easement. He said, no, we cannot allow, the Army Corps of Engineers cannot allow them to go under that reservoir until there's been an environmental impact review. So because the way that Energy Transfers had kept from doing an environmental impact review is by only going, you know, an acre at a time, piece by piece through hundreds of miles, because if they only did piece by piece, they wouldn't have to get an environmental impact statement to get the permit. So they got their permits piece by piece, so deceitful, completely manipulative. And so Obama said, okay, look, you know, there has to be an environmental review. So then as soon as Trump came in, he switched it. He signed a document, an executive order saying, no, we're going forward with DAPL, the Dakota Access Pipeline, and we're going with Keystone XL, which Obama had also stopped. From that point forward, the Energy Transfers Partnership, which he had been an investor in, and which Rick Perry, who is the head of our energy department, gagged me with a spoon, he too was a big investor in and had been on the boards, key boards of Energy Transfers. They felt that they had the victory and they were moving forward with the pipeline. However, it's not over, and there's still a tremendous struggle going on, and that's something that Danny should take over and talk with you about, because he's been up in North Dakota for months. We have a team of 12 people on a legal and investigative team. They're working on all different fronts, not only on defense but on offense. And it is our prayer and our hope that people will continue to stand with Standing Rock, because the confrontation they have with the oil industry is one that's going to affect all of us. Because if precedents are set up there that will make it easy to squash protesters and to threaten them and frighten them and scare them away from being a protester, as we move towards increasing climate change and people are going to want to stand up and protect their water and their land, it's very important that we protect our civil rights and our constitutional rights and our ability to protest. And that's what's going on in Standing Rock. Danny, are you there?
That's a really killer intro. And, you know, the turmoil and the sacrifice, the bloodshed, the inspiration, the leadership, the human liberated energy that has focused on these protests has been staggering. And I want to point out, by the way, our good friend Bonnie Raitt is going to be playing, who's been such a wonderful help to all these great movements to save humankind and to save the planet, has worked with both of us, all of us, over the decades, is going to be playing in Rapid City. She has done benefits for the tribe. I'm sure her concert Saturday night in Rapid City will be full of energy and joyous solidarity for the cause here. And
I just want to give a shout out to her. She's a tremendous person as well as one of the truly great musicians of our generation.
Yes, she is.
Danny, you've worked with her as well, of course, and Sarah. So now tell us, Danny, more about the legal side of this. Sarah's done a beautiful job on the whole tableau, but you're the lawyer. I know that you've been sued along with Greenpeace and a number of other environmental organizations in a RICO suit. Give us the detail and tell us where we stand now on stopping this thing legally.
Well, it's important for people to understand from a strategic point of view what the context of this really is that without going into extreme detail, the bottom line is that this decision to on the part of the United States to move into the Middle Eastern oil field and seize control of the Middle Eastern oil fields was instigated right at the very point where George H.W. Bush, when he was president of the United States, and in 1990, remember, he was vice president under Reagan from 1980 up to 1988 through the first two terms. And then he became president in 1988. In 1990, when the Central Intelligence Agency first began briefing him on the prospect of the Soviet Union withdrawing from the Cold War and Gorbachev getting ready, which he did on December 31st of 1991, you know, signing the decree releasing all of the different republics from the Soviet Union. That as soon as that happened, George H.W. Bush sent a private handwritten communique to Saddam Hussein in Iraq via April Gillespie, who was the United States ambassador to Iraq at the time. And George H.W. Bush had a personal relationship with Saddam Hussein because George H.W. Bush had been the CIA director 1975 to 1977 under Gerald Ford. The George H.W. Bush, now the president of the United States, sent a handwritten note to Saddam Hussein saying, look, I know that you've been having trouble with Kuwait on your southern border, believing that they've been engaged in slant drilling under your boundary, your border, and taking Iraqi oil. And if you find it necessary to resort to the use of military force against them, I just want you to know that I personally wouldn't view that as contrary to the long-term best interests of the United States. And not surprisingly, Saddam Hussein there and after undertook to invade Kuwait. And George W. Bush and his Secretary of Defense, Dick Cheney, back then in 1990, took immediate advantage of that and went to Saudi Arabia and met with Dick Cheney met with King Fahd and Crown Prince Abdullah and talked them into inviting the United States to come into the Middle East to drive Saddam Hussein up out of Kuwait, back up into Iraq. And that was all a subterfuge on the part of the administration to, in fact, go into the Middle Eastern oil field, drive Saddam Hussein back up into Iraq, and then say, we're not going to take Saddam Hussein out of power. What we're going to do is establish a no-fly zone, which is going to require 250,000 full-time United States military personnel occupying the Middle Eastern oil field. This was a major strategic move made by the Bush administration to seize control of the oil fields to deprive China of having access to the oil. That's what this is all about. And everything that we're witnessing here since this time is in the aftermath of the end of the Cold War, in which now we hear Donald Trump saying, look, we're having to build these pipelines not because we have an energy shortage in the United States. We're doing this to establish absolute total dominion over the energy industry on the planet. And that's what he has said. That's what this is all about. And they have chosen to make their move at Standing Rock. They've made their decision. They're going to start building the two initial main pipelines from the XL tar sands pipeline and the Dakota Access pipeline from the Bakken all the way down through the entire width of the United States, all the way from the Canadian border, all the way to the Gulf of Mexico, right straight through and in the face of total opposition on the part of virtually everybody in the pathway of these pipelines, just to show that they can get away with it. And this is also in the face of 180 nations having come together around the world in December in Paris in December of 2015 directly in the face of a papal encyclical issued by Francis, and in, directly in the face of the United Nations and the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, you know, just complete oppositional defiance disorder on the part of him and his administration, choosing the CEO of ExxonMobil to be his Secretary of State and choosing as his energy chief Rick Perry, a partner in Sunoco Oil Corporation, you know, that this is demented that we're looking at here. This is an absolute open defiance of the entire world, showing that he's going to triple down on the production of petroleum as the primary source of oil and control over the world. That's what this is all about. So a lot more is at stake with regard to Standing Rock and the confrontation there than simply the very important project of protecting the water for the Great Sioux Nation and the people, an 82% population of Native American people. That's extremely important, as is protecting the water of the people, 17 million people who get their drinking water from the Missouri River, where they're building this pipeline directly under the water. This is a major strategic move on the part of Donald Trump and the petroleum industry to maintain complete control over the primary source of energy on the planet. That's what's going on here. And the American people have to rally behind the indigenous people to take a stand to stop this. Now, there's been a lawsuit filed in Washington, D.C., that the Judge Boasberg is a federal judge in the Washington, D.C. A lawsuit has been filed by the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe, Tribal Council, along with the Cheyenne River Sioux Council, asking for a temporary restraining order to stop the construction of the pipeline. Judge Boasberg denied that, asking then for a preliminary injunction to stop the building of the pipeline. He denied that. And they continued through all the way through to building and finalizing the pipeline and started running oil through the pipeline, figuring they were confronting us with a fait accompli. Now we filed the motions there. Entered the Earth Justice, on behalf of the tribes, have filed a motion to ask the judge to declare the finalization in the beginning of the functioning of that pipeline to be unlawful. And we have won that case. We won the order saying that was unlawful because they failed to take into account all of the legally required considerations for their environmental assessment. And now we're trying to get the judge to follow up on it by saying, look, you've declared the completion and putting into operation the pipeline to have been unlawful because they could not lawfully grant the easement for them to do that over that land without a fuller environmental assessment. And now we're trying to get him to say, well, look, in light of the fact that it was unlawful, we got to stop the flow of the oil. We got to order the cessation of the oil, stop the pipeline, and have the pipeline removed from the territory because it was unlawful for them to have done that. That is presently pending in front of the Federal District Court in Washington, D.C. This is, however, demonstrative of another fundamental problem, and that is that the Republican Party, when they took over the United States Senate midway through the two terms of Obama, the last 3 years of the Obama administration, the Senate Judiciary Committee that has responsibility for approving nominations of the president for the federal bench, there 103 federal judges have been blocked by Obama. His appointments, his nominations for 103 federal judicial appointments, the Republican Party, the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Orrin Hatch from Utah, refused to hold any hearings whatsoever for those judges. And so we backed up. There's 103 vacancies in the federal judicial system now. And now Donald Trump is in the process of trying to fill those positions. He's trying to fill them with right-wing, hardcore reactionaries from the Federalist Society. And what we're confronted with here, for example, with Judge Boasberg, now in the Washington, D.C. District Court, he is a Yalie, just like both the Bushes, and he's a member of Skull and Bones. He's a member of a private fraternity, which is a legal fraternity. It's called the William Bennett Williams Inn, which is a whole club of white male lawyers who are criminal defense attorneys for corporate criminals. And he's in that club. He is the judge sitting there. That's why he has over and over and over again refused to grant the temporary restraining order, the preliminary injunction, and even though he's been compelled to acknowledge that it was unlawful for them to build that pipeline, he has still refused to shut off the oil. So the limitations of the judicial system, in light of how totally politicized the appointments have become, is another fundamental issue. So I appeared in front of the American Bar Association.
Danny, I want to ask you, is the flow of the oil now physically impeded by the flooding of these refineries in Texas?
No. They're still pumping the oil at 910,000 gallons per hour down into the Gulf. They're storing it at the present time down in Illinois. They've got huge tanks down in Illinois right next to the Great Lakes. And what they're doing is they're pumping the oil into those tanks right now because they don't want to do anything to stop the flow of oil coming through, because if they stop the flow of oil coming through the pipeline, it changes the status quo. And so they want to maintain the status quo of the oil. Yeah, they're trying to put the burden on us to have to prove to how to stop the flow of oil. So if they stop it,
even though they don't have operating refineries in the Gulf, they're refusing to stop the pumping of oil because it'll change the legal. So they're just sticking them in tanks, which I'm sure are really well made in Illinois, and putting all this oil near the Great Lakes. That's right.
I think they're going to try to start refining some of the oil there, right near the Great Lakes. They're going to reopen some of the major refineries there and try to refine the oil there and try to ship it out through the Great Lakes now.
While
we're trying to repair the refineries. Yes, absolutely.
There's a lot going on. Danny, there's a lot going on,
Pardon?
But I'm a little concerned about time because I want to be sure people know a few things. One is there were 843 water protectors who were arrested and falsely charged with crimes. They are not guilty. They were charged with crimes they did not do. And in fact, all the investigative information that has been coming out, and there's an enormous amount of investigative information that's come out from Intercept, the powerful investigative reporting online organization founded by
it's an enormously
important group. They did a whole series on investigative information about Tiger Swan, the militarized security team that is a private team working with the Energy Transfers group conglomerate, and that shows definitively that the illegalities were done by Tiger Swan and by Energy Transfer Partners. And what has happened here is that Tiger Swan, the offshoot of Blackwater, who worked in the Middle East in a parallel way with Blackwater, came in and started providing leadership to all the law enforcement groups, including the local law enforcement, the state law enforcement from five surrounding states, the National Guard, feds that were sent in. They had nightly meetings, and they ran the meetings, and they referred to the peaceful water protectors as domestic terrorists, jihadist terrorists, who were a threat to the company and to the entire local area. And they ran battle plan meetings. They called them, tonight we plan the battle for tomorrow. They ran a bogus military operation. And when they took over from the local police and began doing that, the violence rocketed against
them. This is devastating stuff. And we are amazingly out of time. I'm going to have both of you back, if you don't mind. We'll schedule either next week or the week after. This is such a huge topic. And, you know, it's all about energy and it's all about these psychopaths. Trump being, just emblematic, not the whole problem by any stretch of the imagination. Danny Sheehan and Sarah Nelson, if you can come back. And Danny, Sarah, I do want to talk about your struggles with cancer because you have so much to teach about that as well. So we are going to have you both back.
when you can schedule it, either next week or the week after. Tell people, based on this amazing stuff that you've already told us today, how people can get in touch with you and how they can help. And at some point, the music's going to come in and we're going to have to say goodbye. So say this.
Go ahead.
Tell people how to get a hold of you.
Okay. It's so important. I'm asking each one of you that are listening to please go to your computer or your phone and go to LakotaLaw.org. And you will see a video of Danny on the investigative information. You will also see right there a letter, a petition letter that you can send to an attorney in South Dakota, the state attorney in Martin County. He can dismiss all the charges against the 843 water protectors. We have a campaign going to drown that man in pressure to release all the charges against these innocent people, because all the evidence that's coming out shows they didn't do anything, but the other side did plenty. So
it's Lakota, L-A-K-O-T-A, Sarah?
Yes.
I'm sorry?
Lakota,
yep.
L-A-K-O-T-A.org.
L-A-K-O-T-A-Law, L-A-W.org, LakotaLaw.org.
Okay.
There's 40,000 people that have sent this petition letter to this guy this month, and we're going for 100,000. We need all the petition letters possible to go up to this man.
Okay, we'll have you back. So great to talk to you both.
Well, thank you for joining again.
Danny Sheehan.
Thank you,
Sarah Nelson. In Solartopia.
Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.